Welcome to the Environment Journal podcast, which is brought to you in association with Vortex IoT, a market leader in hyperlocal air quality monitoring and innovative clean tech solutions for smart cities. For further information, visit www.vortexiot.com. Hello, my name is Stephen Sorrell, and I'm an author, commentator, and advisor on climate change, low carbon, and renewable energy. I specialise in working with local authorities to prepare plans and strategies on action plans for their climate emergencies, and particularly in renewable energy projects. Every month in this series, I'll be speaking to some of the key figures in sustainability and asking them about the work they're doing, the beliefs they have on climate change and global warming, and their visions for the future. In this episode, we will continue to look at government policy in the run-up to the crucial COP26 conference to be held in Glasgow. A number of local authorities and their representative bodies will be in Glasgow as observers. To discuss the government's progress on the area of climate change and developments in London, we are fortunate today to be able to speak to the Greater London Authority. Shirley Rodriguez is the Deputy Mayor, Environment and Energy, and I'm delighted to welcome her today to join us for this discussion. Welcome, Shirley.
Hi, Stephen.
Should we start with COP26? And obviously, it's all over the press, all over the news, billed as the most important intergovernmental meeting for some time. Let's start then with yourselves, the Mayor's Office, the GLA. London is different to a lot of other UK cities. It's the largest urban area. It's the capital. It has high densities of population. As a result, some of the problems are more keenly felt, like air quality, which we possibly want to come on to. And in Air Quality News last week, editor Pippa Neal reported that in a recent report by London councils, 82% of Londoners were concerned about climate change. I think the mayor's in a unique position in relation to this, because you've got your own statute that sets down your powers and so on. Does that give you an advantage in relation to the position of other local authorities?
I guess it does in the sense that there's a requirement as each mayor comes in that they have a statutory responsibility to tackle climate change. We have a duty as well as a sustainable development duty. So it's very difficult, I think, for a naysayer mayor to come in and not do anything. But in terms of action, climate action, you know, what Sadiq likes to say is that when we're tackling environmental issues, we're also tackling social justice issues as well. So these are the concerns that people in London have on a day-to-day basis, from, you know, how do they pay their energy bills, how do they get about London to get to their jobs or just to socialise, how do they train their children up to, you know, so that they have a good education, all of those things. All come back to what we're doing on climate anyway. So I think whenever we do some activities around programmes on, you know, whether it's renewable energy, we just launched a programme yesterday on Future Neighbourhoods 2030. We look very closely at how we're delivering the outcomes that people want for their lives.
I think the reason I mention that is that I do a lot of work myself with local authorities all over the country, and we have all sorts of discussions about various aspects of climate change. But if I give you an example, standards of energy efficiency above building regulations, I've had loads of discussions with local authorities across the country about what can they do it, can't they do it, is it legal, should they be, what impacts it will have, and so on. And yet London's just got on with it and seems to have achieved much more than anyone else. But if I mention that, they tend to say, oh, well, you know, that's London, as in you're in a different position to them. And I'm not entirely sure that's the case, actually. But so you don't think you've got a specific advantage by that legislation over their powers?
On energy efficiency for new builds, for new developments, possibly, because when the London plan, our London plan includes a requirement for a sort of an energy hierarchy that really pushes sort of energy efficiency, and we go beyond building regulations.
You do, yeah.
So, and I think the latest report shows that we're securing carbon emissions cuts, I think 50% higher than building regulations require. And that's partly down to government abandoning the zero carbon home standard. And by some quirk, we managed to keep that in. And I know government are talking about bringing that back in, but far too late. But that doesn't stop, I don't think, local authorities using their powers of persuasion, I guess, with drivers to try and go further faster. And in fact, actually in London, over the sort of carbon emissions that we have, the mayor only really has control or levers or influence over about 50% of those emissions. The rest of that is down to government. But that doesn't stop us going ahead and sort of working with businesses, for example, to look at what they might be able to do to reduce their emissions, or look in areas, say, beyond the where we do have powers around transport planning.
Yes.
For example, at food consumption or some of these other areas. A lot of it is about just working with the willing, working with the progressive, and getting on with it.
It's leadership, isn't it? I suppose it's leadership in that sense. I just use that as an example, Shirley, because they seem hung up on that. They really do seem hung up on it. And I've had some fairly, well, let's describe them as robust conversations with officers who assure me they can't do anything about this when I'm trying to argue that they can. And I think that's part of the leadership role, isn't it, to aim high and to try and make sure that actions are being taken. I mean, on that particular subject, of course, London was the first of the C40 megacities to declare a climate emergency. Mm-hmm. And Mayor Sadiq Khan has set a net zero carbon net zero carbon target of 2030. How did that come about?
Well, partly because we listened to the science. You know, it was absolutely clear that, you know, we had a 2050 target, but, you know, talking to colleagues, looking at what the science was saying, we were saying that we have to go faster. And obviously, as you mentioned in your introduction, you know, day after day, we're getting more and more evidence of, you know, the code red that the IPCC talked about, and we're experiencing the impacts of climate change now here in London, you know, and in this country and in Europe. You know, this isn't a faraway problem. So setting that 2030 target was really about, we need to go faster. We've got this decade of action to act. We know that we don't necessarily have all the powers to do everything, and there will be some residual emissions that need to be dealt with, but you've got to set that ambitious target and try to do it. As Sadiq says, you've got to try, and even if we may fail, but you've got to try and get there. And actually, some of the things that we're doing, we're showing a lot of progress. So I think, first of all, set that ambition, show that leadership, and bring the coalitions of the willing to get on with it, and others will follow.
Let's move on to government policy then. So actually, you've mentioned in your earlier comments an interesting point, because I was going to say the Climate Change Act 2008, of course, the legal duties under that are on the Secretary of State. They're not on local government, and they weren't devolved down. Now, that doesn't mean there aren't other duties, which you've already referred to, in planning and in air quality and whatever else there might be. But it was interesting that they chose to do it that way. And I wonder whether you think that will change, whether there will be a delegation of strict legal duties for emissions and carbon budgets and whatever. Do you think that will happen?
But it's certainly something the local authorities have been asking for. So UK 100, who we work with very closely, sort of network of UK local authorities, is saying that there should be a sort of climate powers bill, which would look not just the powers, but the funding in order to be able to act. But I think in doing that, we have to show that we are using the powers we already have. And I think there is something there, and you've probably referred to it, I think, in the conversations that you've been having with your local authorities that you've been working with, is, you know, government are, you know, will be reluctant to devolve more powers if you're not already using the ones that you've got to best effect. And I don't think, you know, in London, we certainly do. And we argued for, this was in, second term, I think, of Ken Livingstone's mayoralty, for a climate change duty to be added. So it wasn't there at the beginning when the GLA was established. It was added, you know, a requirement to come up with a strategy and so on, both for mitigation and adaptation. So, and that's because we wanted to do that. But, you know, I think first, I think absolutely, you know, we should have more powers devolved, more funding devolved, but we should also be using the powers that we have already for that.
I think that's an interesting point. I mean, it's not unrelated that you have extra duties and yet have a very good track record of what you've delivered. So sometimes, though, I find the difficulty at local authority level is really one of confidence, to be quite honest. Going back to my conversations about the planning legislation, the Planning and Energy Act 2008, and the applying higher standards and building regs, it's that precise argument, isn't it? One is we can't do it, we're not legally able to, and that's incorrect. But the other is we don't feel we should be doing it. And I think that's where you've just moved on and just got on and done it. And I'd like to see a bit more of that really across local government, I think. But going back to the government, if you look at some of their key policy areas, as I said, last week, we got the net zero roadmap, the HM Treasury review, which is very important, and the heat and building strategy. Those were all late. They've taken an inordinate a length of time to come forward. You can't help feeling they've been rushed out just to try and get them before COP. Nobody's got the chance to read them. Why is the government making such a meal out of finally putting the final pieces of its policy jigsaw into place? What do you think is causing that?
Well, I mean, it's a massive change, isn't it? We're talking about transforming our whole economy to a low carbon economy and to meet those net zero targets. So that this is a fundamental shift, you know, can't think of a bigger shift really. So obviously there are lots of interlocking pieces that need to be negotiated with the different departments. I bet there's probably lots of lobbying going on, as there usually is, both pro and against what people will be doing. And then obviously the issue of how you finance and fund it all. So it is complicated, and you know, it's quite a good strategy. I think what the problem is that we don't have the detail behind it so that we can get on with it either as a city or as local authorities or even other sectors, in industrial sectors or SMEs or whatever. And I think that's what we're all keen on now is, especially given the urgency of action, we need to have, you know, sort of less consultation on the detail and just giving us the powers and funding just to get on with it.
This podcast has been brought to you by environmentjournal.online and airqualitynews.com. Environment Journal and Air Quality News deliver features, opinion, and daily breaking news across many sectors, including sustainability, energy, waste, net zero, climate change, air quality, housing, and transport. Last month, more than 170,000 people accessed its content online, viewing over 210,000 pages on the websites. To stay fully informed with all the latest developments, you can sign up for the free newsletters on both environmentjournal.online and airqualitynews.com. And if you want to comment on this podcast or would like to contribute to future episodes, then do get in touch via hello@environmentjournal.online. Let's move to another area then that I know is of considerable importance to you, and that's air quality.
Yeah.
Funnily enough, I've just written an article for Air Quality News. And what I was talking about was the interface of climate change, air quality, and biodiversity. When we had the Northern Air Quality Conference recently in Manchester, Dr. Gary Fuller was there saying it's really important that when very well-meaning policies are coming through on climate change, they do have cognizance to what the air quality implications are. And he gave some really good examples of where sometimes that isn't the case. So you replace an internal combustion engine car with an EV, and you've definitely got a climate change benefit, but you've still got the particulates from the brakes and the tyres, which hasn't helped air quality. How do you make sure that you try and bring all those bits together in your areas?
So when I started at the GLA in 2016, we had, partly because the climate, the GLA Act required it, you know, strategies for waste, climate, mitigation, adaptation, air quality, and so on. we pulled all those together into one single integrated strategy. And the point was to exactly pick up those interrelationships and the sort of unintended consequences. So that, you know, when we're making a strategy on air quality, we were recognizing the impact on climate change and vice versa. You know, how could this also help develop and deliver on some of our biodiversity and nature targets as well? So that was the foundation.
And that's your environment strategy.
That was published, you know, after lots of consultations and drafts in 2018. And that's really got the foundation of all the policies. And that feeds into our policies on planning, the London Plan, our transport policies, so that they recognise the environmental impacts that they're doing and what are they doing to help deliver on our environmental objectives, or the mayor's environmental objectives, I should say. So one of the key things that you talk about, Gary Fuller, and his conversation is, you know, we're very clear that in London we're talking about mode shift. So we need people to be walking, cycling, using public transport. And then, yes, people will need to use vehicles. Well, how do we make sure they are clean and not contributing to the climate emergency? And that's why we've got a various set of policies, from the ultra low emission zone, congestion charging, and so on, which all work together to try to do that.
You've also got, under the environment strategy, you've got an implementation plan, and you have a report each year saying what you're doing under that. And looking at those, it looks like there's plenty going on. But is it happening fast enough to meet your net zero target for 2030?
Well, we're just doing some remodeling of our 2050 climate plan to see what the 2030 trajectory would mean. You know, but in essence, you know, it means we need to do more faster and better. And the amount of residual emissions will probably be higher in 2030, because, you know, we're not going out to 2050, but that's true of government and probably lots of other people. But what we want to do is make sure that we minimise those residual emissions as far as possible. And we need government help for that, because, you know, as I've said, you know, we only have control really about half of those emissions. So we need government to be doubling down on their portion. And, you know, whether that's from aviation, you know, there are going to be hard to tackle sectors, which means other sectors have to bear the load more, which is why it's so important, for example, that government gives us help on retrofitting, for example.
I mean, you might not necessarily welcome me saying so, but London has been hugely successful, but it is such a dense city, and it does have a transport system that's better than anywhere else in the country. And people see you as having an advantage, but presumably you wouldn't really agree with that.
So yeah, obviously, we have a fantastic public transport system in London, and yes, that does bring advantages, because it allows people, and we want people to use their cars less, especially with those very short journeys under a couple of kilometres. And it's very extensive. It's not everywhere, so there are certain parts of London that don't have as good access or services. So you know. Probably more akin to people in rural areas, but that's a result partly of the way that, for example, bus deregulation was agreed many years ago, and I know there are moves to change that. So hopefully that will change. But you know, when we talk in London about getting people out of cars or some of the other issues that we talk about more generally, advocating government, we recognise there are differences between what is available to London and what is available to other local authorities or rural communities. And you have to get the right policies and frameworks in place for each area.
Indeed. I mean, on the pandemic, of course, it's had a big impact across the whole economy. But one of the things I did think that was quite tragic was the fact that obviously there was a risk using public transport if COVID-19 is rife, and therefore it's effectively reversed advances that we've made trying to get people on buses and trains because of that difficulty. So I get the impression outside of London it's been very slow to get back to anywhere near normal levels. But have you fared a little bit better?
Well, I don't know what the comparisons are, but certainly, you know, we had a very big drop in usage of our public transport network, slightly less on our buses, And that's largely because it's, you know, it's so prevalent across London and people were using it. You know, there were people who couldn't work it from home, you know, so we're still going to work and so on. But we've seen that increase. So, you know, that's good. And, you know, the mayor has been doing lots of campaigns about trying to get people back to London for leisure as well as, you know, getting back into their offices. But it's still not back to pre-pandemic levels. And that is a problem because obviously that affects the sort of the nature of the service. And we're trying very hard to avoid that car-led recovery in London because for all the air pollution and climate reasons we talked about.
Can I go back though? You mentioned the ultra low emission zone. I specifically wanted to deal with that. What's the difference between the ultra low emission zone and the low emission zone, which you also have?
So the low emission zone was introduced, you know, in previous administrations. I think first under the first administration, targets HGVs, so heavy goods vehicles, buses, lorries. So that has been working very well, and we've just had new data that showed, I think it was like 95% compliance with the standards. So, you know, we've been absolutely, you know, really pleased with the response that businesses have made. And that's really combined with, you know, with the ultra low emission zone and now its expansion. You know, we expect to see many more, much more sort of air quality benefits accruing across London because of that. I think we're thinking the estimates were like even over 100,000 more Londoners will no longer be living in illegal levels of air pollution. So these policies, you have to be taken together, but they are very effective. And as I said, you know, some of these things, like the low emission zone has been going for several years. And so I think businesses have factored that into their business decisions, their sort of procurement cycles and so on. Similarly with the ultra low emission zone, you know, we started when we were talking about tightening the standards with the toxicity charge, really to let people know this was coming. You know, lots of time to prepare, you know, over and above the discussions, you know, at election time that this was coming in. And again, we'll have seen masses of, you know, a really, you know, amazing response by people. So when we talked about it, 39% of vehicles were thought to be compliant. That's more than doubled. So it's now 87%. So, you know, that's still, because we've expanded the area, a lot of vehicles, you know, potentially affected. But that's a huge difference, and that has meant a massive difference, you know, we believe will make a big difference in air pollution.
I read somewhere that the impact of that extends well beyond London because all the trucks have got satellite tracking, haven't they? And they realise that they go across large parts of the rest of the country, and because they qualify to get in your LEZ, then other people are getting the benefit that London causes.
That's true, absolutely. That, you know, because, and it's true of the ultra low emission zone as well. But, you know, so whilst the zone only goes up, covers inner London up to the North and South Circular, the people who are you know, in compliant cars, cleaner cars, and are driving, you know, they're driving through outer London and beyond. So, you know, those benefits are being delivered sort of more broadly than in London. And I think, you know, it's helping more generally the UK's air quality problem.
I'm finding the Environment Bill a bit disappointing, to be honest. After the Lords made those amendments that we all supported, I see the government's given in on the one in discharging raw sewage into rivers, but a lot of the other stuff they haven't, have they? Making the new body more powerful, giving it the same powers as we had under the EU and so on.
Yeah. Very disappointed too. The mayor's been long raising concerns about the Environment Bill not going far enough to protect people from the health impacts, for example. You know, it really is a sort of once in a generation opportunity. It's taken so long to get an Environment Bill. You know, we've been supporting national cross-party calls on this, you know, particularly on incorporating the WHO, World Health Organization guidance on PM on the face of the bill as a legally binding target. That doesn't look like it's going to happen. It's incredibly disappointing. But we carry on lobbying hard for that, and also powers to tackle all the other sources of pollution.
The last thing I wanted to ask on COP26 is in three parts, really. Yeah. One is, what's the most desirable outcome from COP26? Two is, what's the more likely outcome? And three is, what would be a disastrous outcome?
Well, I mean, we obviously need the ambitious targets and commitments from nation states, you know, recognising that we are in this decade of action and we have to limit emissions to those to secure a 1.5C, you know, no more than a 1.5C temperature rise. That's the ambition. We've already seen signs that, you know, we're not going to get the financial agreement that, you know, certainly Global South nations are needing. So that is a bit worrying. But, you know, we still have the conference. The whole point is that those negotiators come together and, you know, hopefully can pull something out of the bag. I think the positive side of it is that, you know, alongside of all of this, we have what we call the non-state actors. So cities, businesses, NGOs going up to Glasgow to demonstrate what action is already happening. So Sadiq, the mayor, has just been elected and is now the chair-elect of C40, a global organisation of megacities around the world, tackling climate change, but also, you know, the twin dangers of climate change and air pollution. And they're going, you know, to demonstrate the immense activity that is happening, that has happened over the years since that the organisation was first established. And there are loads of businesses going up there making commitments. So I think that's the positive side of it. And I think when we were talking earlier about, you know, the role of the GLA and local authorities and, you know, what can you do if you don't have the powers, in the end, it's about your commitment and you don't have the powers to get on with it. And I think that's exactly what cities and businesses are doing. And collectively, with all those commitments, that is, you know, national governments cannot deliver, certainly without cities, local authorities. They have to bring us, you know, along. And luckily, a lot of us are doing a lot of work that is going to help them meet targets.
Very last question then. What about you as a person, live in London? What do you do to try and help with climate change and your carbon footprint?
Well, I don't eat so much meat these days. I don't own a car. In London, as I said, it's much easier not to. But, you know, public transport, try and walk a bit more. And that's probably a hangover from lockdown and COVID. Try not to buy so much. I mean, you know, our consumption emissions in London are 3.5 times our direct emissions. And we're doing a lot of work now about, you know, we know what they are, but what more can we do about, you know, with food waste or clothing, but even just like personal choices, just thinking about not buying so much.
Yes, that's interesting. I was reading in an article recently on the idea of your carbon shadow rather than your carbon footprint, about it not just being about your personal responsibility and your own travel and your own consumption and whatever, but also what impact you have potentially on others. Well, Shirley, we're out of time, so we'll have to leave it there. Thank you very much for such an interesting discussion about climate change and energy. London, as we said, is the capital city of the country, an important flagship for the UK, and we're all interested to know a little bit more about it. And you've given us a great insight into the work that you're doing and aspirations for the future. So thank you very much for contributing today to this edition of the podcast. As usual, we've discussed some key issues in this podcast. If you have any comments on this episode or would like to make your voice heard, you can get in touch via email at hello@environmentjournal.online. And don't forget to subscribe through your podcast platform of choice. It will be good to hear from you. This podcast has been brought to you in association with Vortex IoT, a market leader in hyperlocal air quality monitoring and innovative clean tech solutions for smart cities. For further information, please visit www.vortexiot.com.